were really wonderful days. If a newcomer put his foot over the door, the threshold, he was usually mobbed by an eager and enthusiastic gang of people who wanted more than anything else in the world to give this new person what they had already found, a way to live without the use of alcohol. A year after that, there seemed to be talk of setting up some center place, some local headquarters to handle these AA affairs that were growing in number every day. And what a furor that idea caused. You see, in this period of time, out of that original group had grown 13 other groups in the Boston area. And in these 13 other groups were a lot of younger and more progressive AAs, and they felt that there ought to be some system to this method of handling 12-step calls, of providing speakers, of hospitalization, and all the various chores in AA. And so they wanted to open an office. Well, the old-timers, and God love them all, I don't speak disrespectfully of any old-timer in this room, because what would we have done without them? But anyway, these old-timers did yell and shriek, and they said, what's the matter with the way we do things now? What are you trying to do, organize AA? Why don't you keep it simple? How are you going to run an office? It'll cost $10,000 a year, and we've got $39.72 in the treasury. Well, in case you've forgotten, the locale of all this was in Boston. And one of the things that Boston is famous for, in addition to its culture and its tea parties, is its Irish population and its politicians. You know, we say out in Boston that to be a member of AA, you don't have to be Irish, but it sure helps to get you there faster. Well, in this group of the 13 from the newer groups, naturally, there were a few Irishmen and a few politicians. So they got together to figure out how we could bring the two factions together. They came up with a solution. They appointed one of the old timers as chairman of this Central Service Committee. And did that work? Boy, they quieted down just like a squalling baby does when it gets involved. They said, well, goodness, it's alive. These people, these young people, recognize our superior knowledge and our accumulated experience by appointing one of us as chairman. Why, they must be all right. We'll go along with them. And so was created the first Central Service Office in New England. And I was behind the desk as its secretary. Lucky me. I had thought that for the first 6 months or a year it would be not too busy, that I'd have a lot of time on my hands, but that wasn't so at all. Right from the start, it was very active. Many were the people that used to come in there to find out what could be done for a beloved husband, a wife, or son, or daughter. And sad indeed were the stories that used to pour across that desk. Very bewildered and perplexed were these anxious relatives of alcoholics who tried everything in the world to help their loved ones and met only with failure after failure. Those were really, as I look back on them, wonderful days. We didn't have much money, you remember that $39.72 balance, But we sure did have a lot of fun. Speaking of the money part of it, after we'd been open about a month, the door opened one afternoon and two very nice looking, well dressed men came in. They were strangers. I was there alone, and I thought probably they were visiting firemen. And the thought even crossed my mind, you see, I was pretty young and naive in those days, that maybe these were a couple of trustees from the Alcoholics Foundation who'd come over to look over this wonderful Boston office. So I put my most charming smile of welcome on and went over to greet them and asked them to come in. One of them said, Madam, I am Captain Doucette of Station 16. He flashed his badge at me. Well, that was a bit of a shock. But I still invited them to come in and sit down. They went on to tell me that they'd had a complaint about the office. You see, we hadn't even had enough money to have the name of the outfit printed on the door. And so he said that several other tenants in the building had called up and reported that a very mysterious office had opened at 39th Avenue on the third floor. It was a peculiar sound. One gal in it. No name on the door. All day long, very odd looking men going in and out. I suppose they thought it was a booking joint, or even worse, I don't know. At any rate, when I explained to the two police officers what it was and why the name wasn't on the door, they changed, of course, and were full of enthusiasm and promised all kinds of cooperation if I ever got a drunk that was too hot for me to handle. And incidentally, in the years that I was there, only once did I have trouble with a drunk. He was a young chap who'd only been in about a year, I guess, and this particular day he was on his 29th slip in that year. And he came over to the office, although he'd been told to keep away from it when he was drinking. And he was pretty fresh and belligerent. He was telling what was the matter with AA and what a bunch of phonies they were and so forth. And because there were a couple of real new people, brand new, in the office, I took this fellow in my small private office and said to him, now look, Johnny, you've got to go out. You can't stay here and talk like that. Well, that was just like putting a mash to a keg of dynamite. He really took off then. And he began to curse and swear and say, who the hell did I think I was ordering him around? And after all, every meeting he went to, he put a dime in the box, and therefore I couldn't even eat unless he put that dime in. So how did I get that way, giving him orders? Well, it amused me, but at the same time, it made me kind of mad. However, I didn't have to call the police. Even though it was pretty big, I just took him and pushed him right out the door. When I got him out there, I said, now, don't you ever come back here again when you're in this condition. He came back a week later sober, apologized, and he said, he never did come back again drunk. Well, I didn't have to call the cops, I suppose it's because I'm an alcoholic, and once a new alcoholic came in, we could establish that common bond that we all have. Well, at any rate, this office served a very useful purpose. In the 3.5 years that I was there, the number of groups in the New England area grew from that original 13 to 110 when I left there. 2.5 years ago. And its purpose always Is your other local moving office is to be your servant and you help to carry the message. In the summer of, when? 1949, I was invited to leave the Boston office and go down to New York to be one of the AA secretaries at the Alcoholic Foundation, your general service headquarters. It seemed like a wonderful idea because not only would it bring new blood into the New England office, but was certainly a grand opportunity for me to see how this thing worked throughout the world. I was very lucky again when I went down there because of my past business experience and training. There was assigned to me the job of working with Bill. Certainly, the hours and the days that I spent in his company have been the most helpful and the most interesting of my entire life. During the spring and summer of 1950, our work was devoted almost entirely to the preparation of this Third Legacy pamphlet, with which I'm sure most of you are familiar. The idea for this Third Legacy grew out of the realization by Dr. Bob and Bill that they were perishable. They couldn't last forever. Their friends as the trustees are almost unknown to the AA movement. In years to come, the trustees couldn't possibly function without guidance from you people, from the movement as a whole. Somebody or something had to take the place of Bob and Bill. AA is out of its infancy. It's grown up, an adult now. It has the full right and plain duty to accept the responsibility for its service affairs. Unless the foundation is firmly linked through state and provincial delegates to the movement which it serves, a breakdown would someday be inevitable. When these old-timers vanished, this isolated foundation couldn't possibly survive one serious mistake or grave controversy. The AA movement's been lucky so far. It's never had to face a grave crisis. But who knows? Maybe someday it will. And if so, how could a remote bunch of trustees handle such an emergency? AAs all over the country would shout, by whose authority do these trustees speak for us? How do we know they're right? The result would be a strife and controversy in AA, and for our own survival, and for the millions who are yet to come, such a thing must have happened. And so came the Third Legacy idea. I'll never forget when after it had been written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, I used to know this thing by heart. It was finally all set down on paper and sent out to Akron to Dr. Bogg for his final approval. I was at Bill's home about a week later, and Bill and Lois and I were having lunch. The phone rang, long distance, Akron, Ohio calling, Mr. Bill Wilson. It was Dr. Bogg. Bill went to the phone. He came back in about 10 minutes. And on his face, there was an expression of great peace, of relief. Thank God, he said. Dr. Bob has approved the plan. The future of AA is assured. It's safe. Oh, thank God. Next, within a few weeks, we presented the plan to the trustees. They gave their final okay and the green light to go ahead. And 2 weeks after that trustee meeting, Dr. Bob had a bad spell and died. Those words certainly came back with very deep meaning. Dr. Bob and Bill are perishable. And what a miraculous thing that only a few short weeks before he died, Dr. Bob had taken his last action to ensure that this thing will carry on. Gives you the shivers almost, doesn't it? Well, we then sent copies of this thing to every group in this country and in Canada. Generally, it met with wholehearted approval. But there was some disapproval, and what was it? It was just practically the same as the disapproval that was brought up back 4 years before that in Boston by the old timers. The charges were that AA was becoming organized. That this is a scheme for Bill Wilson to make a lot of money. That one I always loved, because actually in this conference plan, every group in the country is invited to send a representative down to New York and who can go over every financial record, every penny cash slip that's ever been signed from the day the foundation opened its doors until right now. But yet they thought it was the scheme for him to make money. Another complaint was that it was a political movement to ensure that this great hierarchy at headquarters would be maintained. And that too was a ridiculous charge, because what the plan does actually is to ensure constant rotation in AA, the sharing by everyone of the responsibility. And loudest of all was the cry, why not keep AA simple? Oh, sure. We want to keep it simple. But there can be such a thing as oversimplification. For instance, we receive at headquarters every Monday morning about 300, between 300 and 400 letters. Now it would be much simpler not to answer those letters. Every month, we send out 8 tons of literature and books. would be simpler not to do that. Every week, we deal with a score of important public relations matters that affect AA as a whole. It would be simpler to do nothing about them. We get hundreds of personal appeals for help. Well, wouldn't it be easier to throw them in the wastebasket? Translations of literature are needed for the foreign groups, and they need help and guidance on every subject. But we could say, well, let them figure it out themselves. We had to. Why bother? Groups in isolated areas that don't have a central office like you have here in Louisville need to correspond with someone who knows group problems, who's had experience with them. Well, we could ignore their pleas for help too and tell them to figure it out themselves. Now these and some other services, we have a list of approximately 16 services that we give to you. These things cost as a foundation about $100,000 annually. To some, this seems to be a very large amount of money. And it's quite true that AA could be kept poor if we didn't ask for any money. It would be simpler, but only for the time being. If these things were not done, AA wouldn't remain simple. Neither the thousands who are yet to come, nor those of us who are already here, will get the help, the guidance, and direction that we need. Another charge was that the conference means politics. But first, take a look at your own groups, your own little groups right here in Kentucky. Suppose that no one was charged with doing the chores. Suppose there were no secretary, no treasurer, no chairman. Suppose that nobody looked after the hospital arrangements. Suppose there wasn't any orderly method of sponsorship. Suppose all these things were left to chance. As a group, you soon fail to function. Well, suppose no money was involved, where would you meet? So each one of you in your own group has to have a little money, a few politics, and a little organization. Isn't that so? Well then, how can AA as a whole expect to operate on any different principle? Suppose that you people sitting there didn't know personally the secretary or the treasurer or the chairman of your group. Suppose that all that you knew about them was that once in a while by mail you got a request for some money from them. Suppose that they just reappointed themselves as secretary, treasurer, and chairman year after year. How long would you people continue to support them, either morally or financially? Not very long, without any linkage, without any direct knowledge of these people. But that's the way the foundation has been operating for years, without any general service conference, and with this one exception. During all of these years, the foundation has had a linkage between it and you people who pay the bills. That linkage was Dr. Bob and Bill. Dr. Bob has already gone. Bill, God forbid, could go any day. And then, what would happen? These vital services there that are responsible for at least half of AA's membership, and certainly its unity, would collapse. And that is why the General Service Conference came into being. That's why Dr. Bob and Bill bequeathed to us the third legacy. That's why I'm gathered together today at Louisville. And that's why tomorrow morning a representative, I hope, from every group in Kentucky will meet to choose a state committee to provide a direct contact and linkage to us in New York. And from that committee will be chosen a delegate to the General Service Conference to be held next April. I feel very sure that luck, as I have spoken of it in these few words, won't have too much part in the happening tomorrow. There were 37 assemblies held last year throughout this country and Canada. And in every single instance, the committees chosen and the delegates elected were wonderful, conscientious, capable people. And I'm sure that luck had nothing to do with their choices. I'm convinced, as I'm sure you are, that a kind and loving God is watching over this movement and will continue to watch over it, just as he's watched over you and me. Thanks.